If you want to explore the solar system, getting into low Earth orbit is only half of the journey. You need to be able to go from low Earth orbit to other destinations, and that requires a lot more propellant. And right now, our current rocket offerings are really focused on low Earth orbit, with a few things taking you to, say, geosynchronous orbit. But we don't have a lot that takes you beyond the Earth and low Earth orbit. The traditional answer is a heavy lift rocket. Think of the Saturn V. Think of potentially what will happen with New Glenn or with Starship. But people have been thinking about this problem for a long time, and there are some other really interesting options, ones that maybe won't use propellant at all. So I'm talking about skyhooks. Orbital tethers. These are rotating structures that would allow you to pick up a payload at one orbit and then fling it off at a different orbit. Now, you would need to reboost the tether system itself, but there are many effective and efficient ways that you can do that. And this might solve that middle layer. How do you go from low Earth orbit to going to the moon or going to Mars or out into the solar system in a way that is compatible with the existing rocket offerings? Now, my guest today is Dr. Marcus Landgraf. He is the senior architect at the Directorate for Human and Robotic Exploration at the European Space Agency. And Dr. Landgraf is legendary in his work on various space exploration missions. He was instrumental in the Gaia mission, which is, of course, one of my favorites. And he had a new paper came out, which was all about how we could use rotating skyhooks as a way to boost orbits for various spacecraft and some practical ways that we could see some tests in the near future. So if you're interested in this technology, enjoy this conversation with Dr. Marcus Landgraf. Marcus, what is a skyhook?
So a skyhook is one of these fancy devices that people thought they tried to replace rockets with, right? So rockets are great. And the curse of rockets is that they are, on one hand, too efficient, on the other hand, terrible when it comes to delivering large amounts of payload. So people thinking about that since decades, even centuries, and a skyhook is a rotating structure, extended structure in orbit around a celestial object, and that is propelling payloads to other places.
And I'm kind of, so you see this kind of rotating structure and, you know, it's right there in the name. So I'm kind of imagining this sort of pinwheeling, two-armed machine that is just turning in the upper atmosphere and things are coming up and docking with it and then getting a speed boost as they go and then they get sort of flung out into orbital velocity.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. That's the original idea of the skyhook, to have something that is like rotating and the lower half just matches its orbital movement so that it just dips into the atmosphere, attaches to a payload, and then on the other side, it just throws it at a higher speed out. And then obviously energy conservation, right? So we're not inventing energy. The skyhook itself would lose energy, would go lower, and then would have to recover that by other means.
Okay, so I mean, there's a couple of parts to this. One is just getting the skyhook and deploying it in orbit and setting it up to start rotating. Has anybody done anything like this? Has it ever been tested?
Well, there's only so much tests you need to do for this because it's very basic physics, right? So there's no demonstrator that has done that. And now, that when it comes to this tether technology, which is the part that is the most exotic, so you have this very long tether in space, there have been experiments up to, I believe, 30 kilometers length for skyhooks. And not skyhooks, but tethers in space, in orbit, to see things like what's the tension and what are temperatures that are happening because you're in the vacuum, in the thermal vacuum, and what is there any electrostatic charge that's accumulating on it. And there was even a shuttle experiment in the 90s that was doing the same, and I think the tether broke in that experiment, yeah.
Right. Yeah, and they were even, like, I think, if I remember, there was, like, the possibility of using, like, you running electricity down the tether and using that as a way to actually boost the tether.
Right. Yeah. So that works. If you are very low, you're moving through Earth's magnetic field and you have the Lorentz force that you get either you can generate electricity from that, right? It's because they get a potential difference at the upper and lower end, and then you can kind of close the circuit and make power with that. But that, of course, then slows you down, right? So you're turning orbital energy into electricity. But the other way works as well, right? So you put a current through the cable, and that creates a Lorentz magnetic field, and then you repel yourself from the Earth's magnetic field, and that increases your orbital energy. So that's a way to boost at least for the lower orbits, that works quite well. The higher you get, the Earth magnetic field becomes distorted and weaker, so that doesn't work so well anymore.
And so this idea of having to reboost it, I mean, again, is there a sweet spot? And what appears to be the most economical way to continue to keep the tether from sinking too far down?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question because it's complicated and depends on a lot of parameters. So if you're very low, the Lorentz way to doing that is good because you have a lot of solar energy. You turn that into electricity and use that. So you need zero propellant. It's a rather simple system. And that part, by the way, has been tested in the frame of the Space Shuttle mission. So they tested that. So, and they could see, they send a current through it and it started moving, right? So the whole thing, and then it would actually exert a force on the shuttle, which is very small, but they could measure it. So that was successful. So that would be a great way to do that in a low orbit. Now, the real trick that you're doing with this, on one hand, you avoid rocket propulsion, but you pay for it with a reboost that somehow you have to also use. If you're at a higher orbit, you also have to use rocket propulsion. The big deal about this is you have a lot of time for the reboost. So you can use a highly efficient rocket propulsion system, like, for example, a solar electric power. So you have a. So say you don't want to use this Lorentz trick because you're too high up, say at, I don't know, 3,000 kilometers and too far away from Earth, so it doesn't work with a magnetic field. Then you can have these iron thrusters, right, that basically separate and use an inert gas, turn it into ions, and then accelerate them with a electrostatic field. And of course, you need electricity for that. And it gives you a specific impulse. If we are talking rocket propulsion, I'm sure your viewers know very well the Tsiolkovsky equation. Then all of a sudden, instead of having a chemical engine that has a specific impulse of, say, 320 seconds, you can use a solar electric propulsion system with 3,000 seconds of specific impulse. But then, of course, you have this low thrust, but that low thrust can then operate over months, while your spacecraft is already on its way because you slung it out into towards the moon or wherever you need to go.
And I'm assuming, like I remember with the Planetary Society with their LightSail 2, they were testing out how you could change the orientation of the solar sail depending on which part of the Earth you were at, and you could sort of change it, parallel to the sun, horizontal to the sun, and go back and forth. And I'm guessing again, if you've got lots of time on your hands, then you can take advantage of other propulsion techniques that are extremely efficient, like say solar sails.
Exactly right. So in the end, it's to the goal of this whole idea is to beat the curse of the rocket equation, right? So you want to find alternatives to rocket propulsion as much as possible, and if you have to use it, you use as efficient as possible.
Right. And then I guess the big issue is like, how do you actually attach your payload to the Skyhook?
Yeah, that's one biggie because there's only so much time, right? So just imagine what's happening. You're the payload, right? So you're either suborbital or in low Earth orbit, and then there's this thing coming down from above towards you, right? And it's ahead of you, and it's coming down initially rather quickly. So it looks like the collision is going to be a collision, and then it slows down because it has the cyclical motion, right? And you're here, right? So this thing comes here and then goes out like that, and then this moment where there you have a couple of minutes to make the rendezvous,
Hmm. And of course, it appears from your perspective, like if you're just say in a balloon and this tether is coming down, but because this thing is in orbit, then from your perspective, the anchor point to the tether actually appears motionless in your sky. And then you connect.
Correct.
And
because you're matching basically the skyhook matches its orbital motion with the lower end. So it's relative to the payload is at rest when you do the rendezvous. But that condition exists for a couple of minutes. Well, theoretically, even for 0 minutes, but it's slow enough for a couple of minutes so you can attach. So it's very different from if you watch like a rendezvous with the Dragon capsule with the space station. It's very slow process, very controlled, and the speeds considered are like centimeters per second. That is typically relative motion of these vehicles. So that's what we know how to do operationally today. But Skyhook is going to be difficult, very different. So we're talking about meters per second, this thing approaching, and then you have an attempt, right? So you have an attempt to latch on. And then if you lose it, it's a little bit like a carrier landing for an aircraft, right? If you lose the hook, then you just go around, try again next orbit.
And then the length. So, you know, you mentioned, okay, if you want to get higher, say at 3,000 kilometers, is like, does the longer the tether is, the more time you have in the sort of, like, is there a sort of a sweet spot for the length of the tether?
Exactly right. So it's even linear. So if you double the length, you have twice as much time to do the rendezvous because the rotational speed is half. And then things are slower because your center of mass is on a higher orbit. So the whole thing is slower. But of course, then you need more material for it. So ultimately, what you want to do, you want to look at the business case, right? So you drive everything from top down, say, okay, I want the space transportation system that is commercially more viable than a high energy rocket, like a three stage cryogenic rocket.
And then is there a sort of like, how fast is this tether moving through the atmosphere? Is it moving it at orbital entry velocities, or is it moving at a speed that it's not going to try and catch on fire?
Yeah, so it depends on what you're doing, on the payload, basically. So the original concept from back in the 80s, and it was not my idea, it was other people developing that, was to have a supersonic payload that is moving parallel to the tether with, say, Mach 3, 4, 5, something like that. And then the tip would be matching that. So when the tip enters the atmosphere, it has also this Mach 5 figure in the same direction. So it's at rest with the payload being picked up. In the most recent work we've done, we actually completely separated from this complexity of rendezvousing in the atmosphere. And we said, we'll pick up the payload in LEO, so in low Earth orbit, instead of the atmosphere. So there has to be a rocket initially to put you in low Earth orbit, and then the Skyhook picks you up from there and throws you to the Moon or Mars. That's the idea of the most recent work. The reason why we made that change was that in the last 10 years, rockets to LEO have seen a significant economic development where all of a sudden things become relatively cheap and it is almost too much of a supply of these services to LEO, but there's a lack of supply for services to higher orbits or higher energy transits to the Moon and Mars. So that gap is intended to be closed by a Skyhook.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that when you just get to low Earth orbit, you're only really a fraction of the way to get to to climb out of the gravity well to get up to the moon. That imagine the moon not as this thing that's floating in space, but as this at the top of a very tall mountain. And you know, if you think how hard it is to climb, you think about how hard it is to climb, say, Mount Everest. Now imagine Mount Everest is 400,000 kilometers away. It's a bigger mountain, and you've got to use a lot of that energy.
Exactly the right analogy. Yeah, and the weird thing is, if you compare the Saturn V rocket that was designed to go to the moon to say a Falcon 9 rocket that's designed to go to low Earth orbit, the design is already significantly different because Saturn V was a high-energy rocket that had three stages, while the Falcon 9 is a two-stage reusable rocket that is optimized for much lower orbital energies. So you would not be able to make money these days with a rocket like the Saturn V, not only because it's old tech, but the design is really specifically to go to the moon.
And so you're envisioning some future where you've got this, a tether, maybe one tether that sends things to the moon, another tether that maybe sends things to Mars. It's rotating, it's being refueled with ion engines, or it's ion engines, and then payloads are launching on very traditional Falcon 9s, and then instead of a kick stage to take them off to the moon or off to Mars, they're just meeting up with the tether. The tether is kicking them off into whichever orbit you need, and that saves you this sort of entirely different class of rocket.
Right, right, exactly right. And you're more in the segment where you can buy a service that is currently under a lot of competition, so your cost goes down. So it's really not an engineering idea. It's more like how to engineer a space program, not a space vehicle, but the whole program where you look at what is your real cost and how can you benefit from economic developments that are happening right now.
And I think when people are watching this sort of rush to the moon, I mean, we've seen so many rockets going to the moon in the last couple of years and so many failures. A lot of it is that the mission designers don't have a lot of mass left over to actually design a very robust spacecraft. They're stuck with a few hundred kilograms to try and put this whole spacecraft together to try and touch down safely on the moon. And as we've seen, this goes very wrong. And so in theory, these designers will be able to put a lot more mass into their Falcon 9 and still have it arrive at the moon without just expending all of their fuel on the kick stage.
Right, exactly right. That makes the whole deal easier, yeah.
I mean, that's great, and, you know, sending more stuff to the moon, but is there, like, any possible way that this becomes propellantless from pulling payloads off of the surface of the Earth?
I don't see a way doing that with a Skyhook.
No,
that really
no.
then becomes a space elevator.
I mean, I know that people are working on really high altitude stratospheric balloons. Is there no way that you can have your Skyhook come down to the point that it can meet up with the balloon and pull the payloads off the top of the, you know, some payload area on the balloon or even from the ground?
It's a brilliant question, Fraser, I tell you, but I let me be skeptical at this point. Let me tell you why. Because it's not the altitude and it's not the atmosphere that hurts you. It's the velocity. In order to get the tip of the tip of the Skyhook down so it matches Earth's rotational speed, that turns out to be, because of the orbital velocity of the center of mass, you basically have to build a space elevator. So all the requirements on the material become extreme. And you cannot build a low Earth orbit, a thingy that rotates so fast that it would touch down with orbital velocity because of the stress on the cable. Because that would be the same stress that you would have on a space elevator.
Right. So you're essentially building, like, if you want to do that, you're building a space elevator.
Yeah. Yes.
And it's rotating.
Yeah. Which is, and it's makes the speed, it even more not complicated. The altitude. Right. It's
right.
It's the speed, not the altitude. That's why the balloon doesn't help. And it would be just my take on it off the top of my head. I would probably have to sit down with my team and find out.
There was, did you ever read the book Seven Eves?
No.
So they use skyhooks in Seven Eves as a way to get to and from the surface of the Earth, and you know, because everybody had moved to the moon, and then they had this way to be able to go to and from the surface of the Earth, and it was very much these giant tethers that were rotating, and you would meet up with them, you'd be going supersonic speeds, you'd latch on, and then that would throw you up into orbit, and it would save you the fuel. I think they even use like gliders and stuff. Anyway, you know, who knows if Neal Stephenson had actually done the math on this, but it's such a great idea, and I think. Yeah. You know, if there's some way to meet halfway, and I guess you have less time to dock up with the tether, and the tether is going very fast, and you've got to be going very fast. Like, And at a certain point, it just makes sense to just go with the tried and true rocket to get into low Earth orbit. And then you can let all of this stuff take over. I get that. Would it make sense to use one tether? Or do you sometimes, are there ways that you can chain them together?
Yeah, there is all kinds of interesting stuff, ideas out there. So in our most recent work, we kind of chained them together virtually, right? We had two independent on different orbits, and one would throw it from LEO to an intermediate orbit, and then the second would pick it up from there and throw it to the moon. And this whole idea was only to achieve this with a minimum mass of the system itself while using existing materials. That was kind of the constraint. Now, can you do other things with materials that are not existing today, but maybe we're on the way, like little bit improved materials? Absolutely. I mean, there's a big space out there where you can start talking about multiple tethers on a single skyhook, right? So you can even go crosswise instead of just two sides. Or you could there's other reasons why you want even parallel tethers, because you might lose one because there's might be a debris hit to it and stuff like that. So this whole field just in general is completely under researched to some extent, because rockets are selling more payloads these days, and it's an exciting topic in general.
It is hard to get away from the simplicity of the two-stage. If we do reach that fully reusable two-stage rocket future, it's really hard to come up with anything that would outcompete that idea, even the space elevator. And then what about, we'll get to space elevators in a second, but what about capture? So could you go the other way around? Let's say you set up a rotating tether at the moon or at Mars to catch payloads and put them into low orbit.
Absolutely. And that's one of the ways you can actually recuperate the orbital energy, right? So you have an up leg and you lose the elevate. So the skyhook would lose energy as you are throwing payloads up. But you can have payloads that come from the moon and you want to send them to Earth, right? And then you capture them, and then that would increase your orbital energy of the skyhook. So you basically trade the energy between the two. And from the physical foundation, why is that so all of a sudden such a groundbreaking thing? The reason is that in the vacuum, you don't have anything to push against. And that's why rockets are such a difficult thing, because you have to use the reaction principle of Newton to push against your own exhaust. And that makes them, on one hand, very efficient, but on the other hand, terrible, because you have all this propellant that you have to lift, and then you need more propellant to lift more propellant, and so on. You get this exponential function from it. You can break that by, indeed, having something to push against. And the most simple mechanical connection between two points is a tether. And that's why these skyhooks become very interesting and will remain interesting. The question is, do you need them? And like you said, the reusable rockets are catching up on the efficiency of such a system. Now, just a word of warning about that. We haven't seen a fully reusable rocket yet, other than, the space shuttle came close, but the space shuttle turned out to be expensive, right? And, Starship is interesting, great, has done a lot of interesting prototype flights, but you can also see in those prototype flights how difficult the recovery of the upper stage is, because you're coming back at orbital speed, which is completely... an order of magnitude more difficult than recovering the booster. Recovering the booster, we have done it in Europe decades ago with Ariane 5 already. That's not crazy magic. But recovering something that has been in orbit is at least an order of magnitude more difficult, because you have like 100 times more energy in it. So you need this heat shield to work. The shuttle has achieved it. The shuttle story, of course, it's not cheap.
And wasn't without risk. It was
an enormous risk. Exactly right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess the last part of this is the materials.
Yeah.
Give me a sense of the state of the art of the materials out there and how they relate to being able to use these for tethers.
Yeah. So most recent research wasn't really focusing on materials, just to let you know that perhaps there's people out there who know much more than I do or my team knows about materials. What we did is we looked at, perhaps some people remember my TED talk from 2012 when I was talking about, we can improve the materials and just, find a way of spinning the nanotubes into something that can hold together. And the progress on that has existed since the last 10 years or so, but it's very slow. And they're also hitting a wall now where if you start spinning carbon nanotubes, it's not a single molecule, it's just two molecules held together. And the length of these molecules might be a couple of centimeters. So you need lots of them to put them together to reach 150,000 kilometers. So there's been progress, but not to the point where you say, here it is, we can have a space elevator. I think the most exciting development recently has been the industrial production of monolayer graphene. And that has happened, and people are trying. Now, like for the carbon nanotubes, much of the focus is on the more on the conductive properties, not on the mechanical properties, because that's where the money is. But graphene is one of the things that we should be looking at if we want to start thinking about the space elevator. Now, the space elevator, there's also another interesting fact about it, is if you build one for the moon, not for Earth, the material is more than sufficient to do it because the moon gravity is much lower and the rotational speed of the moon is much lower. It needs to be very long, though, because the equivalent of the geostationary orbit for the moon is if you're in the Earth-Moon libration point number one, so because the moon is in bound rotation, and that is about 80,000 kilometers from the moon's surface, so that would be a very long cable, but it is doable with existing material.
Now, yeah, things like spectra, like various composite fabrics available.
Yeah. Composite, polymer composites, yeah.
And you don't think those polymer composites would work for skyhooks?
They would, but the skyhook is not the space elevator. It has a lot of disadvantages, in particular the reboost, right? The need to reboost it for the skyhook gives you the problem of complexity, of operational risk, of you still have to put propellant there, you have to refill it. So it's rather complex. The skyhook, the space elevator compared to the skyhook, if there wasn't the problem with the material, would be much better because the Earth rotation would be the reboost mechanism because you have connected it to the Earth rotation. And every time you lose energy on the elevator, the elevator would slow down the Earth rotation just so slightly, unmeasurable, of course, that's how the energy is compensated in the elevator. For the skyhook, you have to bring back, either you have to use the Lorentz force or you have to bring propellant up.
Mm. So what would be like a practical test? I mean, you've gone and looked again at the idea of skyhooks and done the math, but next would be great to see some kind of practical test. What would you like to see?
Yeah, I'd love to see just a demo mission. That'd be great. And I would suggest doing it as simple as possible, meaning picking up the payload in LEO and throwing it to a higher orbit, and then put a lot of telemetry on it, like measure tension, vibration, temperature, electrostatic charge. And that can be done even by rather small satellites. So I would even think you could do that in a big CubeSat format. Right, so let's, I don't know, what's the biggest CubeSat these days, like 4x4 or something like that. Put them together and then have a, and we did a test like that in Europe decades ago with a mini satellite. It was called the Yes Tether, built by students here in Esteg in Nordwijk. And that was, I think it's to this day, the longest tether that has ever flown. And I can't remember the year when it flew. Early 2000s, I believe.
And then if that works, then scale them up and see if it's something that can be made cost effective compared
Yeah.
to the upper stages that are required to go interplanetary.
Exactly right. But perhaps one intermediate step, interesting step, would be to throw payloads on the GTO from LEO. So for geostationary transfer orbit, because that's where the business is with the telecommunication satellites, and you need only one Skyhook for that, so that would be sufficient.
Right. Marcus, what are you obsessed with right now?
Okay, let me. And I have some life journey already behind me, so I'm looking at things like top down very much. So my obsession is with breaking the chains of limited resources. There's a very high level goal for our civilization. So first of all, if you look at that topic very closely, you find that actually resources today are not really limited, right? But that's a whole different discussion. I don't want to go on the sidetrack here. But of course, our rate of gaining access to new resources, that rate of gaining access is a bit has some limits to it. And that's why this whole topic of space elevator and Skyhook is so exciting. Because if you talk about limited resources, then very often you get the argument, yeah, but we have only one planet and there's only so much crude oil on it, whatever, right? But if you look at the whole solar system, you know, the resource, and that's really what keeps me awake at night, is to create prosperity for all humans wherever they are. And I'm convinced, and that's not an analysis or a logical thing, but I'm deeply convinced that it is possible to do that. So poverty, hunger is something that is actually something we do artificially because we choose to do it. I'm convinced everybody can live a very rich, very prosperous life. And all we need to do is to provide the resources to do that. And space exploration and space exploitation and space transportation are the key elements that we have to master to do that. Like people 3,000 years ago had to master to combine copper with tin to make bronze. And all of a sudden they had tools and weapons that were an order of magnitude stronger. So now we have to figure out how to get resources from space and how to live and work in space in a productive way and expand the human sphere of influence into the solar system. I think that's what we need to do.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about, say, the amount of energy that's just falling on your house, that if you just like took the amount of land or prop, you know, of your house and maybe your yard, if you have a house, and then you just calculated the amount of solar energy that's falling on you, and you then just sold that to the grid at the current rate,
Yes.
you would have an income that would
Exactly.
be perfect if you considered the dirt under your feet and the various components that are made in it of carbon, of silicon, of all of that kind of stuff. And you know, you could sell those off. That those materials are readily available. It's a
Exactly.
distribution problem, not and a sort of concentration of power problem, not necessarily a that we can't come up with ways to do it. It's
Yeah.
funny, like whenever you play like a video game where you start with a very small start and then you compound as you build power, you know, solar panels, and
Right.
the solar panels let you build more manufacturing, and suddenly you get this exponential growth of your overall economy. And it feels like that is within reach of us now when you look at the
This.
electrification of various nations like China and even the US and so on, that they're switching over to, you no longer have to go to the places where there's, you know, dead algae buried underground for 10 million years. You can just collect
Exactly
what's
right.
falling on you.
And that's a great example because historically, crude oil, mineral oil, was a contamination. So there were farmers in Texas in the 18th century that treated crude oil occurrences on the surface as a contamination, and they covered them with earth really quick so that there would be some grass growing there so they could feed the cattle. Just a couple of decades later, a Scotsman discovered that you can replace whale oil with this mineral oil, and it's even better because you can refine it into lighter oils and so on and so on. And all of a sudden, everybody says, wow, oil is the biggest resource on the planet, but it's running out. Be careful, it's running out. And that's just 300 years ago. And then along comes uranium, right? And they're basically unlimited power. And then, in Canada, you're doing a great job of extracting the energy from that. And then solar power is extraterrestrial. So even by definition, it's not limited to our planet. So all of these things hint towards we can have a prosperous future. And at the technological stage we are as a species, I feel it's almost a decision to allow poverty and misery and war to continue. And that I think that's I know it's a very idealistic worldview, but it's still, I think that's the driving force behind what my team and I are doing and what we are doing here at the agency in general.
Yeah, absolutely. You go back to first principles and you calculate the amount of energy available, the amount of food available, the amount of water available. There's enough for everybody. It's a distribution
Yes.
problem.
Yes. It's a
And
distribution problem. Exactly right.
those, how you get to the bottom of those distribution issues and all of the externalities and all of that is where it gets complicated, but they are not intractable problems. We can solve them.
And that's politics, and I'm not good at politics. I'm better at space
Right.
engineering, so I stick
Right.
with what I
But
know.
maybe we can avoid the whole problem by just going to space.
Yes, exactly. We can work around the politics by just making us so incredibly prosperous through space exploration that we don't have to bother anymore with, party politics and whatever. So be just everybody's rich and happy, so nobody will use drugs, nobody will have wars anymore.
Marcus, thank you for your time and good luck with your testing a Skyhook.
Thank you very much for having me and sharing my views on that. So thanks, and I hope everybody had a good time to watch it this.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Marcus Landgraf. Now, we had a much larger conversation where I posed to him the question that I'm getting all the time, which is, whatever happened to space elevators? And Marcus has given talks about space elevators, is continuing to watch the development of various materials, and gives sort of what is the current thinking about the possibility and feasibility of space elevators and how they might fit into a larger idea of space exploration. So if you're interested, we've got that longer interview completely for free over on Patreon. You can watch it right now, put a link in the show notes, and get the longer full version. I'm going to give you some final thoughts, but first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Andrew Gross, Braley Griffin, Brian Bowder, Caradwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Bialok, Cy Nielsen, David Gilton, and David Matz, Evan Pro, Hudson Moore, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Modzo, Nick Borges, Nick Solari, Paul Robach, Brin Kaidu, Richard Williams, Sean Sargent, Stephen Fowler Munley, Vlad Chiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. This was a great opportunity to chat with someone who is, in a very senior role with the European Space Agency and yet is obsessed in thinking about these ideas of being able to go to space in a less propellant way, ways that are, more feasible and lower cost over the long term. And I know, like, there's a lot of these ideas that we all really love about launch loops and orbital rings and skyhooks and tethers and space elevators and kinetic launchers and ways to get to space that don't require lighting some material on fire and then having the reaction from that exhaust plume come out the back of your rocket. And for now, rockets work great, but in theory, the laws of physics should let us get to this place where we can have this other technology. And so there's always a place in my heart for anyone who is willing to sit down and actually do the math and consider the possibilities and compare it with our current thinking and just like, what is a practical way that we can move this technology forward. And so I'm always grateful. And so I know a lot of you are really interested in this kind of stuff. And so whenever I see it, I will always try and bring it to you. All right, we will see you next time.